You can see the panel before you. I will ask the clerk to call the second case on our calendar. We have a total of four. Two of them are oral, and you are our second oral case for the day. So, Marshall, if you would call the second case on our calendar.
Now calling A201573, Daniel Loftus, ETAL, v. Jeffrey Manning, and the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development.
All right, and before you start your remarks, counsel for appellant, I just want to say a couple of things. We're obviously appearing by Zoom today, but with that aside, everything else about our court procedures remains the same. So one of those is that no recording of these proceedings is allowed except for the recording that is made by the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And that is an audio recording that will be available to the parties on the website. Now, because we do that, we ask you to start your remarks by identifying yourself as well as the client you represent. And then the other thing I'll suggest is that you keep your eye on the clock, which should be visible on the screen. It tends to go fairly quickly during the course of our conversation. So with that, I think we are ready to hear from counsel for appellant. You can proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Markowitz, and I represent Relators Professional Billiard Services, LLC, and Daniel Loftus. Relators respectfully ask this court to reverse the determination that PBS employed Mr. Manning. Mr. Manning was an independent contractor. There are five factors set forth in the regulations. I intend to focus my time today on the two that the regulations identify as the most important, starting with the most important one, which is the right to control.
Could I stop you just for a moment, though? Because I just want to clarify something. Based on your reply brief, because the ULJ here decided to omit any credibility determination, but you think that based on the undisputed facts in the record that there's enough for this court to decide this matter as a matter of law. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so there's nothing. There isn't any alleged disputed fact that will make or break this case. Is that basically
correct, Your Honor? And that was what I attempted to do with the reply briefs cataloging to show just how little daylight there is between the parties on so many issues, and how if you look through fact by fact that matters, there isn't a dispute this court would need to resolve, or that a ULJ would need to resolve to decide
the matter. And we can almost infer that the ULJ also came to that same conclusion. That's why they didn't think that credibility determination was necessary based on the multitude of undisputed facts. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Proceed. I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify that before we get started.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I will say, I'll go straight to this point. The focus of Deed's brief is on a lot of testimony that comes verbatim quotations from Mr. Manning. Looking at those, what we tried to do in our reply is show how Mr. Manning again and again would say one thing and then basically admit or clarify that thing wasn't really true. We saw that with respect to him saying, I couldn't decline jobs, and then he declines.
Well, let's talk about that, because the point you brought up, my understanding is that he quit. He quit several times, correct, during the course of the 7 years he worked there?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you bring up, you make a big point that he quit. The evidence was he quit. And then after he quit, apparently there was an offer for him to take jobs after he quit, and he said, no, I quit, and he declined then. Am I correct? Is that because it was after about 2 weeks after he quit?
He had not taken a job for a while. I think that the record might be more that in at least declining the first job, that was sort of him manifesting his quitting. And then that second declining was really driving it home. I'm not sure.
I mean, because it was a couple of weeks later after right. He was mad and he said, I'm done, I quit. So it has to be viewed in the context of he thinks he's quit. So he's not coming back at the time the job offer was made or
the job certainly, was offered.
Am I correct?
Yes, and as confirmed by him not appealing that issue, here that is a settled issue.
All right. But it's viewed in the context that he's quit the employment. It's not viewed in the context of him on a day-to-day basis when he's working for PBS, having the option to decline a job during the course of his employment, either as an employee or as an independent contractor.
We can look to his conduct there and look what he actually did. I think if that's what your question's getting at.
Well, it's just that the context would be different. And am I correct? There's nothing in this record that shows at the time that he was admitted, even from his perspective, working for PBS, that he declined a job.
Correct. Too, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Then please proceed. I know you were going to start with the right of control.
Well, and as to that piece, I think the two other most powerful facts that corroborate that Mr. Manning had the discretion to decline or accept a job are the following. One, what we see, what Mr. Loftus does, he offers the jobs to the people who are around and willing to potentially listen. And if not enough take the jobs, he either does one of two things. He gives the job back to the customer, or he does it himself. That's not how someone acts if you have a right to control. And the other piece is the hourly wage arrangement, which while hourly wages are often, you know, a telltale sign of employment, this court's cases such as Don Robinson have recognized that. That's not always the case when the hourly wage is reflecting the circumstances on the ground. And here, one of those circumstances is that movers decide sometimes to cancel jobs in the middle of doing them. And they didn't see it as a fair situation to put in time to spend when due to traffic or having too heavy of a load, they have to say, I can't do this today. The hourly wage exists because workers have the right to cancel jobs in the middle of the day based on their workload. So I think those are two powerful corroborating facts to that point. Zooming out to the big picture, though, on right of control. I mean, it's the right of control, not the exercise of that control that matters. But we live in the real world where we need to look at what is happening on the ground. And we don't see any of those telltale signs of control. You have employment policies and handbooks, training to teach you how to do things the company way. Instead, we have the only training we have, to call it that, is this pool table instruction. But this court has recognized in a few of its cases, I don't know if it came out as strongly in the briefing, about how the difference between training to teach you something you don't know and the difference and training to teach you how to do something the company way. That second one is a right of control situation. The first is not. And I direct the court's attention to one. This is the Black taxi versus taxi cab company decision at page 2, where this court emphasized that there was general taxi cab training given to these guys. This is a non-precedential opinion, but there was general taxi cab training provided, but the training, quote, was not specific or particular to Black driving a cab for relator. And that's the situation we have here. Mr. Manning didn't know how to disassemble a billiard table, so Mr. Loft just showed him. But we know in the ordinary course, he was doing weird work. He was working for MSS and moving everything from taxidermy to flat screen TVs or whatever else the FBI Witness Protection Program or these executives wanted to move. The jobs came through PBS because they were odd jobs. And he didn't look to a manual to figure it out. He looked to his phone. He researched it. He talk to people who maybe were in.
So, Mr. Markowitz, you're making certainly a good point about that particular issue, the training issue. But it seems to me that the ULJ's decision and opposing counsel relies pretty heavily on the fact that PBS had a right to control the means and manner of work, based primarily on this routine of having, you know, daily routes and schedules, and Loftus directing Manning to show up at 7 or 8 a.m. for those daily routes and schedules. Now, as I read the record, I could be totally wrong, so you get to correct me. It was Loftus is directing Manning as to, these are the customers you're going to work for today. this is the order you're going to get there. He didn't tell him how to get there. Manning used his own GPS. Mm-hmm. But this is the work you're going to be doing when you get there. So it seemed to me that that is a pretty significant control in light of our case law. So help me understand your view of that.
I think there's a few pieces I'd like to tease out. I think there's two. One is, what jobs did a person have to take, or what jobs were there delegated or not delegated? And the other piece is this start time issue, that you need to come here by a certain time. And as to the first one, I would refer back to the conversation I was having with Judge Hooten. I think that if you look at this record, you don't see requirements. You don't see Loftus providing, handing down assignments. You're going to do A, B, C today. You're going to do E, F, G. And again, we see one of the most powerful examples that he's not delegating is that they could just say, well, that's just too much. And they could cancel in the middle of the day. Besides the fact that Loftus testifies unequivocally that they can decline jobs, and Manning then impeaches his own testimony when he admits on cross-examination that he actually was able to decline two jobs without discipline. As to the start times, this court has twice in two non-precedential decisions cited in our briefing, Don Robinson and Pembroke. Don Robinson was one of the driver cases for those auto auctions. And Pembroke was an installers of lockers and shelving case. Both of those decisions involved this court expressly engaging with a start time and saying a start time is not the sort of thing that manifests control sufficient in order to show control over how the work is done. And I also would say, as a factual matter here, when Loftus was asked about the start times, he made clear these are suggested start times. They're not required. And that flows from the fact, and we cite that in our briefing. I don't have that pin site readily available, but it is in the transcripts. These are suggested times, which makes sense because the movers don't have to do a job in the first place. This is just a convenient time of day for people to pick up trucks and go along their way. It's not him saying, I'm telling you how to do work. I'm saying, here's how I give out jobs.
Well, can I ask you this? I mean, especially if you're moving biller tables, you're going to need some other workers helping you. Am I correct?
If something is too heavy for one person, yes, you would need two.
All right.
Or a tool.
And there was some testimony about a helper, but this helper was not an employee. There's no evidence that this helper was an employee of Manning. The helper was was working for PBS.
Correct? Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And so that was all arranged by PBS and coordinated by PBS. Am I correct?
No, Your Honor. I would point your attention to page 5 of our reply brief and transcript page 77. This is a situation where Manning never actually testified as to an issue. We only have Loftus's testimony. And on page 77 of the transcript, Loftus is directly asked, are you coordinating movers? And he says, no, they...
But the helper isn't working for Manning. Am I correct?
Correct.
There's no evidence that he's working for Manning.
Correct, Your Honor.
Someone had to be paying him, right? And that's your client, right? Or PBS?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no evidence of coordination. Loftus expressly denied it in his testimony, which went unrebutted. And Your Honor, I would point you to actually a decision not in our briefing, but I found in preparation that you authored from 2013. This is Ride Auto Companies, Westlaw Citation 2013 WL6152181. This dealt with car sale marketers. If your memory goes back about 7 or 8 years, that would be amazing. But you addressed this matter specifically, and the court concluded that the relator does not even assign specific, or the marketers themselves divide up the jobs and collaborate to achieve the end goal of preparing vehicles ready for sale. This was a situation where the marketers needed to work together in order to accomplish tasks, but that wasn't dispositive. What was dispositive is, who's in control here? And the answer was, they were. And that's what this undisputed record shows, that while you might need two people to do something, Mr. Loftus, PBS, they're not controlling that conduct. The movers are figuring out, teaming up, as the record tells us, how to get a job done in a particular day.
Mr. Markowitz, does the record indicate at all in his 7 years while he was working at the moving company that in any given day he like also did his own, you know, a separate moving job for himself, you know, with a different, you know, not one that had been, he'd gotten the heads up from your client, but, you know, okay, now it's 3 o'clock. I've got some time. I'm going to go do this moving job and keep all the money myself.
No, Your Honor. And I was hoping to reach that point and talk about it more broadly, apart from him quitting and stopping the work for that period of a year or so in the middle. But this is a point I wanted to emphasize. And I also direct the court's attention to the CC Eastern decision cited in our briefing from the DC Circuit, also the FedEx decision from the DC Circuit. And CC Eastern recognizes that the right of the employee to take on entrepreneurial activities is the other side of the coin of the right of an employer to control. In neither situation does the exercise of that right to control. Rather, we look at whether you had the right in the first place. And here the record is undisputed. And we set this out in our facts section, one of the earlier sections, that there were other movers who had the ability to and did take moving jobs at companies other than PBS, even if Manning was not availing himself of that. They were advertising on social media. I see my time has expired. If I could conclude this point.
You can wrap up. Remember, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. They were advertising on social media, doing text messages, word of mouth. Even though if Manning was not doing that, we're not seeing indication one way or another whether he was doing so, that whether he took advantage of that is not dispositive. And I note this quote from the CC Eastern decision.
Mr. Markowitz,
okay,
yeah, we should finish now.
Yes, Your Honor.
Like I said, you definitely have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So if you want to continue this part of your presentation, you can do it at that time.
Understood. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. And so, counsel for respondent, we're ready for you.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent the respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED. So though the parties disagree on how to apply the law, DEED agrees that most of the underlying facts are undisputed, and certainly the underlying facts with regard to 4 of the 5 factors. The parties did provide some conflicting testimony related to aspects of control. And on these points, the ULJ's findings of fact are supported by substantial evidence in the record, and that's Manning's testimony. So I'll start by talking about the factor of control, since we've been kind of focused on that factor. So the ULJ found that PBS had the right to control the means and manner of Manning's performance, and then he made some additional, more specific findings consistent with that general conclusion. So first, he found that there were other individuals performing the same services that were coordinated by Loftus. And there is testimony to support this. So when asked, you know, what do you do for your job? Manning testified that he was the one that ran the jobs when Loftus wasn't present, and that he had a full-time helper with them every day that stayed on with PBS. He testified he'd see Loftus in the morning and would meet him out at jobs to help him with jobs. He testified, obviously, you can't move pool tables by yourself. He testified that sometimes Loftus would meet him at a job to put the pool tables together because Manning was never trained how to put them back together. And so, you know, Loftus was telling him, you know, where to go and when, and he was coordinating these different people on the job sites. Manning testified when he was running late, he had to call Mr. Loftus and discuss that. He testified that he was in charge.
Ms. Phillips, before you go ahead with your list, just sure. To back up for a second, you talked about the training that Mr. Manning received to assemble pool tables. Even though that appears to be the name of the business, PBS, it sounds like it was a relatively small portion of their work. Is that right?
I believe that Loftus did testify that it was a smaller percentage of the business. I don't know that Manning ever responded to that.
And I think Mr. Markowitz's bigger point is that instructing a worker as to one particular task isn't the same as controlling the worker's behavior in the way that we normally think of an employer as controlling. I think he referred to it as the company way. So how do you respond to that?
Sure. Let me point to some of Manning's testimony about his training. So he did testify that Loftus showed him how to take pool tables apart. agree with that. When asked how long the training was, Manning testified, I just kind of say that it went over a long span of time. He said, I just kind of learned as I went, and he'd teach me. Every day I was learning something. When counsel questioned him about what the expectations for the job were, he said, well, there were verbal expectations, and she asked what those were. He said that I would do the jobs that he sent and do them to the best of my ability, and the protocol in which he wanted things done. So he testified that there was a protocol, that Loftus was, for all intents and purposes, his boss, and he did what his boss told him to do. So his testimony shows that it wasn't some kind of limited training period at the beginning. This is how you do it. He testified that it was over a course of time, a long span of time, he said, and that Loftus was showing him the way that he wanted things done. In addition to that, Loftus controlled the daily routes and the scheduling. Manning testified he'd show up for work each day at the time that Loftus told him to. Loftus would say, oh, tomorrow's busy. I need you here at 7. We're not so busy. I need you here at 8. He worked Monday through Friday, sometimes Saturday, if Mr. Loftus told him to come in on Saturdays. He testified he had no input or control over his schedule for the day. So this is a point of conflicting testimony, certainly. You know, Loftus said that Manning could pick and choose his jobs, and the ULJ's findings certainly do not show that that was the case. Manning thought that he had to do the work that was there. You know, he did testify that some years back he quit because Mr. Loftus was overbooking jobs and he was working into the night and he didn't want to do that anymore. So, I mean, that shows that it wasn't this type of arrangement that you see in case law where a company would call a driver and say, hey, I have this job for you. Do you want it or not? The driver would say yes or no. This was more like an employment situation where Manning was showing up every day and doing the work that Loftus gave him. And Manning's testimony was, no, I couldn't turn jobs down or I would be fired. So that's all evidence that is supporting control. There's also testimony from Manning that sometimes he disagreed with Mr. Loftus about scheduling or routes. The ULJ asked him, so what happened in those types of situations? And Mr. Manning said, well, it's up to Mr. Loftus. If something was damaged, he was the one who had to pay the claim. So he wanted it done his way. So when there were those disagreements, it was Mr. Loftus's decision how things were done. So that's all evidence that supports the ULJ's finding that PBS did have the right to control the way that Manning performed his job. It wasn't those types of cases where this is the end result I want. Mr. Loftus was involved in a daily basis on telling Manning where he needed to go, what he needed to do, you know, sometimes giving him additional work. So that finding is supported by the evidence. I can touch on the other factors as well here, which are mostly undisputed. So the other big important factor that we have is whether PBS had the right to discharge Manning without incurring liability. And the parties agreed that if PBS decided to terminate his services, it would owe him for nothing other than payment for hours worked. And neither party was required to provide any type of notice. So this factor weighs in favor of employment based on that undisputed fact.
Well, Mr. Markowitz, in his briefing, cited to a number of cases that he believes are controlling here. Would you address those cases? One was the Don Robinson Mulders case.
Sure.
Which appears to be a non-presidential case, but he said this is similar to that.
Sure.
Is similar to this situation.
Right. So the arrangement here is very different from the one in Don Robinson. Don Robinson case is one where this company called drivers that they had on a roster, and they would offer them discrete jobs, you know, to go out and pick up a car at a lot and drive it back to the Don Robinson lot. The facts show that the drivers worked sporadically, they could work for other competitors, and that they could accept or turn down any job they wanted. The facts here are totally different than that. Here, Manning showed up for work every single day, full time, for 7 years, and he did what Loftus told him to do. So this wasn't a case where he's doing these discrete jobs. I'm not sure if it's Robinson or another case where the court reasons, well, the employer wouldn't discharge him in the middle of a job because they weren't, they would just not hire him for future jobs. You know, the reasoning was, the employer wasn't present in the car. If someone did a bad job, they just wouldn't call him for future jobs. This is different than that. There wasn't discrete jobs that Manning was accepting and rejecting. It was continuous, full-time employment, working different kinds of jobs. And to say that PBS didn't have a right to discharge him during the middle of a work day, which is how I construe the relator's argument to be that he wouldn't discharge him in the middle of a job, that he just wouldn't call him for future jobs. I don't think that's plausible. I think, Loftus was there on the jobs a lot of the time, and he certainly had the right to discharge Mr. Manning during a job. So it's just a completely different type of arrangement than in those cases cited by PBS. He could discharge him in the middle of the day, and they had no contract. So the default is that he would be owed for work up to that point, but there's no contractual obligation that they would owe him for anything else. So that's the type of facts that weigh in favor of employment. And it's distinguished, I'll point out St. Croix briefly, because that is a published case where they found independent contractors. But for that factor, the court reasoned that if a NOES assessor was discharged in the middle of a session, the company would still have to pay them for the entire session. So it's different than here. There's no similar type of agreement that PBS would pay Manning for the rest of the day or the rest of the job. It was more like an employment situation where he was hourly, and there was just no there was no liability that would result from PBS discharging him. Kind of moving on to the factor of materials and equipment, the ULJ found that PBS provided necessary equipment. I think Loftus agreed to all of the important things. He drove a truck owned by PBS that featured the PBS logo and phone number. PBS provided a dolly, a saw, packing materials. Manning had PBS business cards. The ULJ did find that Manning provided some of his own hand tools, but by and large, all of the things that were necessary to do this job, PBS provided for him. So this factor weighs in favor of employment. Mode of payment, the parties agree that Manning was paid hourly.
Ms. Phillips, on the truck issue, does the record indicate, was he allowed to keep the truck overnight, or when he showed up every morning, is that when he got the truck?
I believe that he got the truck when he showed up every morning.
Thank you.
Yes, I believe the testimony was he would show up to get the truck.
Was there any testimony about who put gas in the truck?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that either party addressed the gas. So kind of moving on to the factor of pay, they agreed it was hourly. And in fact, Mr. Loftus testified that he did not pay on a project basis because there was this risk of loss. He said, sometimes movers invest time in a job and it's canceled, and that would be a loss for them. Well, it's that type of loss that characterizes an independent contractor relationship. And courts have held, repeatedly that when there is no risk of loss, this is an indication of employment. The last factor, control of premises, the ULJ didn't really mention this factor in the analysis. I don't think it's very important. Most of the work was done at customer locations. In other decisions, the courts have a reason that that's neutral when the work's done at customer locations. The parties did agree that he showed up to that shop every morning to get the truck and to get his instructions. So, we argue that the factor weighs perhaps slightly in favor of employment because there was that requirement to go there every single day. He wasn't keeping the truck at his house and getting these orders electronically or something. There was that contact with the employer at the shop every day. The ULJ reasoned that some other factors supported employment. There was this paid day off that PBS gave him every year, no written contract, and then the fact that there was this continuous 7-year relationship with the exception of one kind of blip where he quit for a period of time. Otherwise, it was about 7 years. So the ULJ balanced all of those factors and found that it was employment. And the record supports the ULJ's findings on the factors, all of the factors. I'm about ready to wrap up with the things I wanted to say. If the court has any.
Well, I just want to ask a factual question. Is it true that, and does the record reflect this, that the major client for PBS was actually another moving company who actually obtained the jobs?
Yes.
That PBS is basically just a broker between that moving company, MMS, and the work, the movers, the actual movers.
It was my understanding that MMS was the major customer, and that PBS provided these types of specialty moving services to multiple customers, but that MMS was its major customer. So I don't know if you'd call it a broker, but certainly, you know, it was providing the specialized service of moving specialty items like pool tables and specialty equipment. So it had a pretty specialized kind of niche moving business, and it worked for other moving companies. So I think you're right that the customers were other moving companies. Deed kind of concedes in the brief that issue of not being able to hire replacements is kind of neutral because it was required by MMS, you know, but that's in light of all the weight of the factors, that doesn't tip the scales at all. So in conclusion, the findings of fact related to each of the five factors are supported by substantial evidence. The ULJ correctly weighed the factors to determine that Manning was an employee. Indeed, respectfully request that the court affirm the decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So we are ready, or will be in a moment. There we go, with the clock adjusted to hear your rebuttal, Mr. Markowitz. Thank you.
You're muted.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor. We should be used to this by now, but it takes a little bit of time. But I have a number of smaller points to respond to some of the points that just came up. My larger point I'd like to start with is this. When we see a lot of factors, sometimes it can feel a little bit like alphabet soup and it could be hard to get our bearings. But I think the reason the right to control is so important is because of the burdens and responsibilities that come with that right. The law says if you are an employer, if you have a right to control how people do their work, then we're going to say you have a great deal of responsibilities. And here being employment, unemployment taxes and that burden. And that right of control simply is not there. Dovetailing of where I ended and talking about something that came up during the argument is the right to entrepreneurial activity and the continuity of Mr. Manning's work. It cannot be that a person's choice to return to a contracting relationship over and over and over and over again with a business because they like the work and they like the consistency. It cannot be that continuity and that those choices by the worker impose or suggest a right to control by the employer. And I think it's telling that that continuity factor was removed from the regulations as being indicative one way or the other on this point. As to the question regarding the pool tables and whether it was a smaller part of the business, it was. If you look at page 4 of our opening brief in the facts section, it was roughly 15% of PBS's business, and the remainder being pre-moving location services. As to the broker question, that PBS is not a broker. PBS preps weird stuff for moves. And so they do pre-moving work with things like taxidermy and big screen TVs and weird flat top granite tops. And so they prepare it to be moved by companies, like primarily being MSS. As to the training piece, we've cited a lot of non-precedential opinions, which I think are persuasive and notable in quantity. But there's also St. Croix, which has a number of the propositions we're urging, including for training. In St. Croix, there was some limited training acknowledged by the court, and it made this point. They pointed out the fact that the training was only provided in two circumstances. One, when required by industry standards, not an issue here. And the other was when someone didn't know how to do the thing. And that's exactly what we have here. You have to synthesize the limited training reference in the body of the opinion with how it's explained in the facts, but that's what was happening. And St. Croix is a precedential proposition to say training that's just required to gap fill what someone doesn't know how to do, that is not training that evidence is a right to control. There's a lot of reference to Manning's testimony. And I think the important distinction, and when you're looking at what he says, is to push past what is his perception and what is actually testimony regarding the facts on the ground. The great example of it is him asserting at one point that everything needed to be run by Mr. Loftus. He asserts this in the briefing. We block quote this. We go through it in page 13 of our reply. But then when pressed by the ULJ, he says, at ULJ asks, are you sure Mr. Loftus told you that? Oh, yes, he told me that. In those exact words, well, no, not those exact words. And ultimately, it boiled down to he thought Loftus was an employer. And so he says, because of my perception that this is an employment thing, I thought I had to do what Mr. Loftus would suggest to me or tell me to do or ask me to do. But his perceptions can't control. We need to look at what are the facts on the ground. There was some reference to Mr. Manning, just a few other pieces. If you look at pages 10 to 13 of our reply brief, you don't need to now, but that's an area where we go through step by step. I think some of the key points where Mr. Manning says X, but then Mr. Manning either admits that X isn't really true, or he explains and clarifies that X doesn't really mean X. He says Loftus had a protocol or guidance from how he should do things. Pressing further, he was just talking about the pool table situation and how you move a pool table. He says that Mr. Loftus assigned jobs, but he admits that he can, he doesn't have to take them. And of course they can be, and the record also shows they can be canceled. He says if he would turn down a job, he'd be fired, but we know he wasn't. Also on appellant's brief 9, this didn't, he also testifies, we mentioned at the top of our brief, at page 9 of the opening brief, Manning testified that he was required to come to these PBS morning meetings, but he was pressed about that on transcript pages 39 and 46 about how was that requirement communicated to you? And he said, oh, we would discuss it the day before. This is what Loftus is saying. He would identify the day before if there were jobs that were going to be available. And if you want to show up, you show up. Manning would use the language of requirements, but then back off and just say, well, we discussed what needed to happen. I see my time has expired. If I can pose on the court just for about 30 more seconds, I had a few short points to address. There was some talk about Mr. Loftus being on the job site. That's an area with a small fact dispute that doesn't really matter. Loftus said he was out there about 20% of the time. Manning said it maybe was around 40% of the time. But that's pages 35, 63, and 75 of the transcript. But ultimately, there's no evidence that Mr. Loftus was supervising. Mr. Loftus says on page 75 what's true. He saw himself as one of the movers. He helped out when help was needed. Sometimes he was there, sometimes he was not. And there is zero evidence of supervision, performance reviews, or discipline based on that. As to the question about gas money. Oh,
Mr. Markowitz, it's time now. Yes, so is there one last thing you'd like to say?
Yes, this piece, Your Honor,
on
the gas money question. Ed, there is nothing in the record about who paid for gas, but on page 70 of the transcript, we do note Loftus was asked, do you cover the expenses of the movers? And he says, no, there's no digging further into that, but I imagine expenses are one of the typical things. Gas money is a typical expense for a truck. I thank you for the court's time thank you.
Thank you. We very much appreciate hearing from the lawyers today about this case. It's a very interesting one, and we're deeply appreciative for your detailed briefing on it, which we will carefully refer to. So this matter is now referred to the court for its decision.